gives a false name, which leads more easily to his detection than his real one, and purchases, under a pretext that the rats prevent him from sleeping, 5 or 6 pennyworth of arsenic. If he is really a cunning fellow, he goes to 5 or 6 different druggists or grocers, and thereby becomes only 5 or 6 times more easily traced. Then, when he has acquired his specific, he administers duly to his enemy, or near kinsman, a dose of arsenic which would make a mammoth or mastodon burst, and which, without rhyme or reason, makes his victim utter groans which alarm the entire neighbourhood. Then arrive a crowd of policemen and constables. They fetch a doctor, who opens the dead body and collects from the entrails and stomach a quantity of arsenic in a spoon. Next day, 100 newspapers relate the fact with the names of the victim and the murderer. The same evening, the grocer or grocers, druggist or druggists, come and say, "It was I who sold the arsenic to the gentleman accused," and rather than not recognize the guilty purchaser, they will recognize 20. Then the foolish criminal is taken, imprisoned, interrogated, confronted, confounded, condemned, and cut off by hemp or steel. Or, if she be a woman of any consideration, they lock her up for life. This is the way in which you Northerns understand chemistry, madame. Derues was, however, I must confess, more skilful. "Oh, what would you have, sir?" said the lady, laughing. "We do what we can. All the world has not the secret of the Medicis or the Borgias." "Now," replied the count, shrugging his shoulders, "shall I tell you the cause of all these stupidities? It is because, at your theatres, by what at least I could judge by reading the pieces they play, they see persons swallow the contents of a phial, or suck the button of a ring, and fall dead instantly. 5 minutes afterwards, the curtain falls, and the spectators depart. They are ignorant of the consequences of the murder. They see neither the commissary of police with his badge of office, nor the corporal with his 4 men, and that is an authority for weak brains to believe that this is the way that things pass. But go a little way from France, go either to Aleppo or Cairo, or only to Naples or Rome, and you will see people passing by you in the streets, people erect, smiling, and fresh-coloured, of whom Asmodeus, if you were holding on by the skirt of his mantle, would say, 'That man was poisoned 3 weeks ago. He will be a dead man in a month.'" "Then," remarked Madame de Villefort, "they have again discovered the secret of the famous aqua tofana that they said was lost at Perusa. Eh, indeed. Does mankind ever lose anything? The arts are removed and make a tour of the world. Things change their names and the vulgar do not follow them, that is all. But there is always the same result. Poison acts particularly on one organ or the other, one on the stomach, another on the brain, another on the intestines. Well, the poison brings on a cough, the cough an inflammation of the lungs, or some other complaint catalogued in the book of science, which, however, by no means precludes it from being decidedly mortal, and if it were not, would be sure to become so thanks to the remedies applied by foolish doctors, who are generally bad chemists, and which will act in favour of, or against, the malady, as you please. And then there is a human being killed, according to all the rules of art and skill, and of whom justice learns nothing. As was said by a terrible chemist of my acquaintance, the worthy Abbe Adelmonte de Teomine in Sicily, who had studied these national phenomena very profoundly. 'It is quite frightful, but deeply interesting,' said the lady, motionless with attention. 'I thought, I must confess, that these tales were inventions of the Middle Ages.' 'Yes, no doubt, but improved upon by ours. What is the use of time, encouragements, medals, crosses, Monthean prizes, etc., etc., if they do not lead society towards more complete perfection? Yet man will never be perfect until he learns to create and destroy. He does know how to destroy, and that is halfway on the road.' 'So, added Madame de Villefort, constantly returning to her object. The poisons of the Borgias, the Medicis, the Renes, the Ruggieris, and later, probably, that of Baron de Tronc, whose story has been so misused by modern drama and romance, were objects of art, madame, and nothing more, replied the count. Do you suppose that the real savant addresses himself stupidly to the mere individual? By no means. Science loves eccentricities, leaps and bounds, trials of strength, fences, if I may be allowed so to term them. Thus, for instance, the excellent Abbe Adelmonte, of whom I spoke to you just now, made in this way some marvellous experiments. Really? Yes. I will mention one to you. He had a remarkably fine garden, full of vegetables, flowers, and fruit. From amongst these vegetables he selected the most simple, a cabbage, for instance. For 3 days he watered this cabbage with a distillation of arsenic. On the third, the cabbage began to droop and turn yellow. At that moment he cut it. In the eyes of everybody, it seemed fit for table and preserved its wholesome appearance. It was only poisoned to the Abbe Adelmonte. He then took the cabbage to the room where he had rabbits, for the Abbe Adelmonte had a collection of rabbits, cats, and guinea pigs, equally fine as his collection of vegetables, flowers, and fruit. Well, the Abbe Adelmonte took a rabbit and made it eat a leaf of the cabbage. The rabbit died. What magistrate would find or even venture to insinuate anything against this? What procureur du roi has ever ventured to draw up an accusation against Monsieur Magendy or Monsieur Florent in consequence of the rabbits, cats, and guinea pigs they have killed? Not one. So, then, the rabbit dies, and justice takes no notice. This rabbit dead, the Abbe Adelmonte has its entrails taken out by his cook and thrown on the dunghill. On this dunghill was a hen, who, pecking these intestines, was in her turn taken ill and dies next day. At the moment when she was struggling in the convulsions of death, a vulture was flying by. There are a good many vultures in Adelmonte's country. This bird darts on the dead bird and carries it away to a rock where he dines off his prey. 3 days afterwards, this poor vulture, who has been very much indisposed since that dinner, feels very giddy suddenly whilst flying aloft in the clouds and falls heavily into a fish pond. The pike, eels, and carp eat greedily always, as everybody knows. Well, they feast on the vulture. Well, suppose the next day one of these eels or pike or carp is served at your table, poisoned as they are to the third generation. Well, then, your guest will be poisoned in the fifth generation and die at the end of 8 or 10 days of pains in the intestines, sickness or abscess of the pylorus. The doctor opens the body and says, with an air of profound learning, "The subject has died of a tumour on the liver or typhoid fever." "But," remarked Madame de Villefort, "all these circumstances which you link thus one to another may be broken by the least accident. The vulture may not pass at the precise moment, or may fall 100 yards from the fish pond." "Ah, this it is which is art. To be a great chemist in the East, we must direct chance. And this is to be achieved." Madame de Villefort was deep in thought, yet listened attentively. "But," she exclaimed suddenly, "arsenic is indelible, indestructible. In what way soever it is absorbed, it will be found again in the body of the creature from the moment when it has been taken in sufficient quantity to cause death." "Precisely so," cried Monte Cristo, "precisely so. And this is what I said to my worthy Adelmonte. He reflected, smiled, and replied to me by a Sicilian proverb, which I believe is also a French proverb. 'My son, the world was not made in a day, but in 7. Return on Sunday.' On the Sunday following, I did return to him. Instead of having watered his cabbage with arsenic, he had watered it this time with a solution of salts having their bases in strychnine, Strychnos colubrina, as the learned term it. Now, the cabbage had not the slightest appearance of disease in the world, and the rabbit had not the smallest distrust. Yet, 5 minutes afterwards, the rabbit was dead. The fowl pecked at the rabbit, and next day was a dead hen. This time, we were the vultures, so we opened the bird, and this time all particular symptoms had disappeared. There were only general symptoms. There was no peculiar indication in any organ, an excitement of the nervous system, that was it, a case of cerebral congestion, nothing more. The fowl had not been poisoned, she had died of apoplexy. Apoplexy is a rare disease amongst fowls, I believe, but very common amongst men. Madame de Villefort appeared more and more reflective. "It is very fortunate," she observed, "that such substances could only be prepared by chemists, for else, really, all the world would be poisoning each other, by chemists and persons who have a taste for chemistry," said Monte Cristo carelessly. "And then," said Madame de Villefort, endeavouring by a struggle and with effort to get away from her thoughts, "however skilfully it is prepared, crime is always crime, and if it avoid human scrutiny, it does not escape the eye of God. The Orientals are stronger than we are in cases of conscience, and very prudently have no hell. That is the point." "Really, madame, this is a scruple which naturally must occur to a pure mind like yours, but which would easily yield before sound reasoning. The bad side of human thought will always be defined by the paradox of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. You know, the mandarin who is killed at 500 leagues distance by raising the tip of the finger? Man's whole life passes in doing these things, and his intellect is exhausted by reflecting on them. You will find very few persons who will go and brutally thrust a knife in the heart of a fellow creature, or will administer to him in order to remove him from that surface of the globe on which we move with life and animation, that quantity of arsenic of which we just now talked. Such a thing is really out of rule, eccentric or stupid. To attain such a point, the blood must be warmed to 36 degrees, the pulse be at least at 90, and the feelings excited beyond the ordinary limit. But if passing, as we do in philology, from the word itself to its softened synonym, you make an elimination, a simple change of words. Instead of committing an ignoble assassination, if you merely and simply remove from your path the individual who is in your way, and that without shock or violence, without the display of those sufferings which, becoming a punishment, make a martyr of the victim and of him who inflicts them a butcher, in every sense of the word, if there be no blood, no groans, no convulsions, and above all, that horrid and compromising moment of accomplishing the act, then one escapes the clutch of the human law which says to you, do not disturb society. This is the mode in which they manage these things and succeed in eastern climes, where there are grave and phlegmatic persons who care very little for the questions of time in conjunctures of importance.
Yet conscience remains, remarked Madame de Villefort, in an agitated voice and with a stifled sigh.
Yes, answered Monte Cristo. Happily, yes, conscience does remain. And if it did not, how wretched we should be. After every action requiring exertion, it is conscience that saves us, for it supplies us with 1,000 good excuses of which we alone are judges. And these reasons, how excellent soever in producing sleep, would avail us but very little before a tribunal when we were tried for our lives. Thus Richard III, for instance, was marvellously served by his conscience after putting away of the 2 children of Edward IV. In fact, he could say, these 2 children of a cruel and persecuting king, who have inherited the vices of their father, which I alone could perceive in their juvenile propensities, these 2 children are impediments in my way of promoting the happiness of the English people, whose unhappiness they, the children, would infallibly have caused.
Thus was Lady Macbeth served by her conscience when she sought to give her son, and not her husband, whatever Shakespeare may say, a throne. Ah, maternal love is a great virtue, a powerful motive, so powerful that it excuses a multitude of things, even if, after Duncan's death, Lady Macbeth had been at all pricked by her conscience.
Madame de Villefort listened with avidity to these appalling maxims and horrible paradoxes delivered by the Count with that ironical simplicity which was peculiar to him. After a moment's silence, the lady inquired, "Do you know," she said, "Monsieur le Comte, that you are a very terrible reasoner, and that you look at the world through a somewhat distempered medium? Have you really measured the world by scrutinies, or through alembics and crucibles? For truth to say, you are a great chemist, and the elixir you administered to my son, which recalled him to life almost instantaneously, oh, do not place any reliance on that, madame.
One drop of that elixir sufficed to recall life to a dying child, but three drops would have impelled the blood into his lungs in such a way as to have produced most violent palpitations. Six would have suspended his respiration and caused syncope more serious than that in which he was. Ten would have destroyed him. You know, madame, how suddenly I snatched him from those phials which he so imprudently touched.
Is it, then, so terrible a poison?"
"Oh, no. In the first place, let us agree that the word poison does not exist, because in medicine use is made of the most violent poisons, which become, according as they are made use of, most salutary remedies.
What, then, is it?
A skilful preparation of my friends, the worthy Abbé Edelmonte, who taught me the use of it."
"Oh," observed Madame de Villefort, "it must be an admirable antispasmodic."
"Perfect, madame, as you have seen," replied the Count. "And I frequently make use of it, with all possible prudence, though, be it observed," he added, with a smile of intelligence.
"Most assuredly," responded Madame de Villefort, in the same tone. "As for me, so nervous and so subject to fainting fits, I should require a Dr. Edelmonte to invent for me some means of breathing freely and tranquilizing my mind in the fear I have of dying some fine day of suffocation. In the meanwhile, as the thing is difficult to find in France, and your abbé is not probably disposed to make a journey to Paris on my account, I must continue to use the antispasmodics of Monsieur Planchet, and mint and Hoffman's drops are amongst my favourite remedies. Here are some lozenges which I have made up on purpose. They are compounded doubly strong."
Monte Cristo opened the tortoiseshell box which the lady presented to him, and imbibed the odour of the pastilles with the air of an amateur who thoroughly appreciated their composition.
"They are indeed exquisite," he said, "but as they are necessarily submitted to the process of deglutition, a function which it is frequently impossible for a fainting person to accomplish, I prefer my own specific."
"Undoubtedly. And so should I prefer it, after the effects I have seen produced. But of course it is a secret, and I am not so indiscreet as to ask it of you."
"But I," said Monte Cristo, rising as he spoke, "I am gallant enough to offer it you. Only remember one thing. A small dose is a remedy. A large one is poison. One drop will restore life, as you have witnessed. Five or six will inevitably kill. And in a way the more terrible, inasmuch as, poured into a glass of wine, it would not in the slightest degree affect its flavour. But I say no more, madame. It is really as if I were advising you."
The clock struck 6:30, and a lady was announced, a friend of Madame de Villefort, who came to dine with her.
"If I had had the honour of seeing you for the third or fourth time, Monsieur le Comte, instead of only for the second," said Madame de Villefort, "if I had had the honour of being your friend, instead of only having the happiness of lying under an obligation to you,
I should insist on detaining you to dinner, and not allow myself to be daunted by a first refusal. 1,000 thanks, replied Monte Cristo, but I have an engagement which I cannot break. I have promised to escort to the Académie a Greek princess of my acquaintance, who has never seen your grand opera, and who relies on me to conduct her thither. Adieu, then, sir, and do not forget my recipe. Ah, in truth, madame, to do that, I must forget the hour's conversation I have had with you, which is indeed impossible. Monte Cristo bowed and left the house. Madame de Villefort remained immersed in thought. "He is a very strange man," she said, "and in my opinion is himself the Adelmonte he talks about." As to Monte Cristo, the result had surpassed his utmost expectations. "Good," said he, as he went away, "this is a fruitful soil, and I feel certain that the seed sown will not be cast on barren ground." Next morning, faithful to his promise, he sent the prescription requested. 54. Robert le Diable. The pretext of an opera engagement was so much the more feasible as there chanced to be on that very night a more than ordinary attraction at the Académie Royale. Levasseur, who had been suffering under severe illness, made his reappearance in the character of Bertram, and, as usual, the announcement of the most admired production of the favourite composer of the day had attracted an audience consisting of the very elite of Parisian fashion. Morcerf, like most other young men of rank and fortune, had his orchestral stall, with the certainty of always finding a seat in at least a dozen of the principal boxes occupied by persons of his acquaintance. He had, moreover, his right of entry into the omnibus box. Chateau Renaud rented a stall beside his own, while Beauchamp, in his editorial capacity, had unlimited range all over the theatre. It happened that on that particular night the minister's box was placed at the disposal of Lucien Debray, who offered it to the Comte de Morcerf, who again, upon his mother's rejection of it, sent it to Danglars, with an intimation that he should probably do himself the honour of joining the Baroness and her daughter during the evening in the event of their accepting the box in question. The ladies received the offer with too much pleasure to dream of a refusal. To no class of persons is the presentation of a gratuitous opera box more acceptable than to the wealthy millionaire, who still hugs economy while boasting of carrying a king's ransom in his waistcoat pocket. Danglars had, however, protested against showing himself in a ministerial box, declaring that his political principles, as well as being a member of the opposition party, would not permit him so to commit himself. The Baroness had, therefore, dispatched a note to Lucien Debray, bidding him call for them, it being wholly impossible for her to go alone with her daughter to the opera. There is no gainsaying the plain fact that a very unfavourable construction would have been put upon the circumstance of two females going together to a public place, while the addition of a third, in the person of her mother's admitted lover, enabled Mademoiselle Danglars to defy malice and ill nature while visiting so celebrated a place of amusement. Thus, then, we perceive that for a mother, however innocent and pure-minded, to conduct her child alone to operas or spectacles would be deemed a breach of decorum. But to go thither under the guidance of one who, if not actually her seducer, might in time become so, made all right and set the world at defiance. Let others reconcile these strange inconsistencies if they will. We confess it above our powers. The curtain rose, as usual, to an almost empty house, it being one of the absurdities of Parisian fashion never to appear at the opera until after the commencement of the performances, so that the first act is generally played without the slightest attention being paid to it, that part of the audience already assembled being too much occupied in observing the fresh arrivals and noting each batch of élégantes as they take possession of their boxes to have eyes or ears for the business of the stage, while the noise of opening and shutting doors, with the mingled buzz of many conversations, effectually prevents even those few who would listen to the orchestra from being able to do so. "Surely," said Albert, as the door of a box on the first circle opened and a lady entered, resplendent with beauty and jewels. "That must be the Countess G." "And who may she be, pray?" inquired Chateau Renaud carelessly. "What a question! Now do you know, Baron, I have a great mind to pick a quarrel with you for asking it, as if all the world did not know who the Countess G was." "Ah, to be sure," replied Chateau Renaud. "I remember now. Your lovely Venetian, is it not?" "Herself." At this moment the Countess perceived Albert, and returned his salutation with a graceful smile. "You are acquainted with her, it seems," said Chateau Renaud. "France introduced me to her at Rome," replied Albert. "Well, then, will you do as much for me in Paris as he did for you in the Queen of Cities?" "With much pleasure." "Silence!" exclaimed the audience. This manifestation on the part of the spectators of their wish to be allowed to enjoy the rich music then issuing from the stage and orchestra produced not the slightest effect on the two young men, who continued talking as though they had not even heard it. "The Countess was present at the races in the Champ de Mars," said Chateau Renaud.
"Today?"
"Yes. Bless me, I quite forgot the races. Did you bet?"
"Oh, merely a paltry 50 louis.
"And who was the winner?"
"Nautilus. I betted on him. But there were 3 races, were there not?"
"Yes. There was the prize given by the Jockey Club, a gold cup, you know, and a very singular circumstance occurred about that race."
"What was it?"
"Silence!" again vociferated the music-loving part of the audience. "Why, that it was gained by a horse and rider utterly unknown on the course."
"Is that possible?"
"True as day. The fact was, nobody had observed a horse entered by the name of Vampa or that of a jockey styled Job, when at the last moment a splendid roan, mounted by a jockey about as big as your fist, presented themselves at the starting post. They were obliged to stuff at least 20 pounds weight of shot in the small rider's pockets to make him wait. But with all that, he outstripped Ariel and Barbaro, against whom he ran, by at least 3 whole lengths.
And was it not found out at last to whom the horse and jockey belonged?"
"No.
You say that the horse was entered under the name of Vampa?"
"Exactly. That was the title."
"Then," answered Albert, "I am better informed than you are, and know who the owner of that horse was."
"Silence there!" cried the whole collective force of the parterre, or pit. And this time the tone and manner in which the command was given betokened such growing hostility that the two young men perceived, for the first time, that the mandate was addressed to them. Leisurely turning round, they calmly scrutinized the various countenances around them, as though demanding some one person who would take upon himself the responsibility of what they deemed excessive impertinence. But as no one responded to the challenge, the friends turned again to the front of the theatre and affected to busy themselves with the stage. At this moment the door of the minister's box opened, and Madame Danglars, accompanied by her daughter, entered, escorted by Lucien Debray, who assiduously conducted them to their seats.
"Ha-ha," said Chateau Renaud, "here come some friends of yours, Viscount. What are you looking at there? Don't you see they are trying to catch your eye?"
Albert turned round just in time to receive a gracious wave of the fan from Madame la Baronne. As for Mademoiselle Eugénie, she scarcely vouchsafed to waste the glances of her large black eyes even upon the business of the stage.
"I tell you what, my dear fellow," said Chateau Renaud, "I cannot imagine what objection you can possibly have to Mademoiselle Danglars. That is, setting aside her want of ancestry and somewhat inferior rank, which, by the way, I don't think you care very much about. Now, barring all that, I mean to say she is a deuced fine girl."
"Handsome, certainly," replied Albert, "but not to my taste, which, I confess, inclines to a softer, gentler, and more feminine style than that possessed by the young lady in question."
"Bless my heart!" exclaimed Chateau Renaud, who, because he had seen his 30th summer, fancied himself duly warranted in assuming a sort of paternal air with his more youthful friend. "You young people are never satisfied. Why, what would you have more?
Your parents have chosen you a bride who might serve as the living model of the hunting Diana, and yet you are not content. No, for that very resemblance affrights me. I should have liked something more in the manner of the Venus of Milo or Capua, but this chase-loving Diana, continually surrounded by her nymphs, gives me a sort of alarm, lest she should some day entail on me the fate of Actaeon. And indeed it required but one glance of Mademoiselle Danglars to comprehend the nature as well as justness of Morcerf's remark. She was certainly handsome, but her beauty was of too marked and decided a character to please a fastidious taste. Her hair was raven black, but amid its natural waves might be seen a species of rebellion to the hands that sought to band and braid it. Her eyes, of the same colour as her hair, were richly fringed and surmounted by well-arched brows, whose great defect, however, consisted in an almost habitual frown, while her whole physiognomy wore that expression of firmness and decision so little in accordance with the gentler attributes of her sex. Her nose was precisely what a statuary would have chosen for a chiselled Juno. Her mouth, which might have been found fault with as too large, displayed teeth of pearly whiteness, rendered still more conspicuous by the over-redness of her lips, beside which her naturally pale complexion seemed even more colourless. But that which completed the almost masculine look Morcerf found so little to his taste was a dark mole of much larger dimensions than these freaks of nature generally are, placed just at the corner of her mouth, and the effect tended to increase the expression of unbending resolution and self-dependence that formed the characteristics of her countenance. The rest of Mademoiselle Eugenie's person was in perfect keeping with the head just described. She, indeed, reminded you of the hunting Diana, as Chateau Renaud observed, but with a more haughty and resolute air than statuaries have bestowed on the chaste goddess of the silver bow. As regarded her attainments, the only fault to be found with them was the same that a fastidious connoisseur might have found with her beauty, that they were somewhat too erudite and masculine for so young a person. She was a perfect linguist, a first-rate artist, wrote poetry and composed music. To the study of the latter, she professed to be entirely devoted, studying it with indefatigable perseverance, assisted by a schoolfellow who, having been educated with the view of turning her talents to account, was now busily engaged in improving her vocal powers in order to take what she was assured by her friend she would infallibly attain, a leading position at the Academy of Music. It was rumoured that she was an object of almost paternal interest to one of the principal composers of the day, who excited her to spare no pains in the cultivation of her voice, which might hereafter prove a source of wealth and independence. But this counsel effectually decided Mademoiselle Danglars never to commit herself by being seen in public with one destined for a theatrical life. And acting upon this principle, the banker's daughter, though perfectly willing to allow Mademoiselle Louise d'Army, for so was the future debutante named, to practice with her through the day, took especial care not to compromise herself by being seen in her company. Still, though not actually received at the Hôtel Danglars in the light of an acknowledged friend, Louise was treated with far more kindness and consideration than is usually bestowed on that most unfortunate class of deserving females styled governesses. The curtain fell almost immediately after the entrance of Madame Danglars into her box. The band quitted the orchestra for the accustomed half-hour's interval allowed between the acts, and the audience were left at liberty to promenade the salon or lobbies, or to pay and receive visits in their respective boxes. Morcerf and Chateau Renaud were amongst the first to avail themselves of this permission. For an instant, the idea struck Madame Danglars that this eagerness on the part of the young Viscount arose from his impatience to join her party, and she whispered her expectations to her daughter that Albert was hurrying to pay his respects to them. Mademoiselle Eugenie, however, merely returned a dissenting movement of the head, while with a cold smile she directed the attention of her mother to an opposite loge situated on the first circle, in which sat the Countess G, and where Morcerf had just made his appearance. "So we meet again, my travelling friend, do we?" cried the Countess, extending her hand to him with all the warmth and cordiality of an old acquaintance. "It was really very good of you to recognise me so quickly, and still more so to bestow your first visit on me."
"Be assured," replied Albert, "that if I had been aware of your arrival in Paris and had known your address, I should have paid my respects to you long ere this. Allow me to introduce my friend, Baron de Chateau Renaud, one of the rare specimens of real gentlemen now to be found in France, and from whom I have just learned that you were a spectator of the races in the Champ de Mars yesterday." Chateau Renaud bowed to the Countess.
"Were you at the races, then, Monsieur le Baron?" inquired the Countess eagerly.
"I was."
"Well, then," pursued Madame G. with considerable animation, "you can probably tell me to whom belonged the winner of the Jockey Club Stakes."
"I am sorry to say I cannot," replied the Baron, "and I was just asking the same question of my friend Albert."
"Are you very anxious to know, Madame la Comtesse?" asked Albert.
"To know what?"
"The name of the owner of the winning horse."
"Excessively. Only imagine. But do tell me, Monsieur le Vicomte, whether you really are acquainted with it or no."
"I beg your pardon, madame, but you were about to relate some story, were you not? You said, 'only imagine,' and then paused. Pray continue."
"Well, then, listen. You must know I felt so interested for the splendid roan horse with his elegant little rider, so tastefully dressed in a pink satin jacket and cap, that I could not help praying for their success with as much earnestness as though the half of my fortune were at stake. And when I saw them outstrip all the others and come to the winning post in such gallant style, I actually clapped my hands with joy. Imagine my surprise when, upon returning home, the first object I met on the staircase was the identical jockey in the pink jacket. I concluded that by some singular chance, the owner of the winning horse must live in the same hotel as myself. But lo, as I entered my apartments, I beheld the very gold cup awarded as a prize to the unknown horse and rider. Inside the cup was a small piece of paper on which were written these words, 'From Lord Ruthven to Countess G.'
"Precisely. I was sure of it," said Morcerf.
"Sure of what?"
"That the owner of the horse was Lord Ruthven himself."
"What Lord Ruthven do you mean?"
"Why, our Lord Ruthven, the vampire of the Sal Argentino."
"Mercy upon me!" exclaimed the Countess. "Is he here, too?"
"To be sure. Why not?
And you visit him? Meet him at your own house and elsewhere?"
"I assure you he is my most intimate friend, and Monsieur de Chateau Renaud has also the honour of his acquaintance."
"But what makes you so convinced of his being the winner of the Jockey Club prize?
Was not the winning horse entered by the name of Vamper?"
"What of that?
Why, do you not recollect it was the appellation of the celebrated bandit by whom I was made prisoner?"
"True,
and from whose hands the Count extricated me in so wonderful a manner?"
"To be sure, I remember it all now."
"Now, I argue from the circumstance of the horse and bandit bearing the same singular name that the Count was the person to whom the unknown horse belonged.
But what could have been his motive for sending the cup to me
in the first place? Because I had spoken much of you to him, as you may believe, and in the second, because he delighted to see a countrywoman take so lively an interest in his success.
I trust and hope you never repeated to the Count all the foolish remarks we used to make about him."
"I should not like to affirm upon oath that I have not. Besides, his presenting you the cup under the name of Lord Ruthven proves his knowledge of the comparison instituted between himself and that individual."
"Oh, but that is dreadful. Why, the man must owe me a fearful grudge for so doing."
"Does his offering you the fruits of his victory seem like the conduct of one who felt ill will towards you?"
"No, certainly not."
"Well, then,
and so this singular being is in Paris?"
"He is.
And what effect does he produce?"
"Why," said Albert, "certainly during the first week of his arrival here, he was the great lion of the day. Nothing else was thought of or talked about but the wonderful Count of Monte Cristo and his extraordinary actions.
Then the coronation of the Queen of England took place, followed almost immediately afterwards by the robbery of Mademoiselle Mars' diamonds, and two such interesting events turned public attention into other channels.
"My good fellow," said Chateau Renaud, "the Count happens to be so great a favourite of yours that you treat him as carefully and delicately as though he were your best and most intimate friend. Do not believe what Albert is telling you, Madame la Comtesse. So far from the sensation excited in the Parisian circles by the appearance of the Count of Monte Cristo having abated, I take upon myself to declare that it is as strong as ever. His first astounding act upon coming amongst us was to present a pair of horses worth 32,000 francs to Madame Danglars. His second, the almost miraculous preservation of Madame de Villefort's life. Now it seems that he has carried off the prize awarded by the Jockey Club. I therefore assert and maintain, in spite of whatever Morcerf may advance, that not only is the Count the object of universal remark, interest, and curiosity at this present moment, but also that he will continue to be so while he pleases to exhibit an eccentricity of conduct and action which, after all, may be his ordinary mode of amusing himself as well as the world."
"Perhaps you are right," said Morcerf, "but just cast your eyes towards the box formerly belonging to the Russian ambassador, and tell me, if you can, who is the present occupant of it."
"Which box do you mean?"
"The one between the pillars on the first tier. It seems to have been fitted up entirely afresh."
"Did you observe anyone during the first act?"
"Where? In that box?"
"No," replied the Countess. "It was certainly empty during the first act."
Then, resuming the subject of their previous conversation, she said,
"And so you really believe it was your mysterious Count of Monte Cristo that gained the prize?"
"I am sure of it.
And who afterwards sent the golden cup to me?"
"Undoubtedly."
"Then do you know," said the Countess, "I have a strong inclination to return it. I cannot understand receiving such presents from a person wholly unknown to you."
"Do no such thing, I beg of you. It would only produce a second goblet formed of a magnificent sapphire or hollowed out of a gigantic ruby. It is his manner of acting, and you must take him as you find him." At this moment, the bell rang to announce the drawing up of the curtain for the second act. Albert rose to return to his place.
"Shall I see you again?" asked the Countess.
"If you will permit me to make a second visit between the next pause in the opera, I will do myself the honour of coming to inquire whether there is anything in which I can be useful to you in Paris."
"Pray take notice," said the Countess, "that my present residence is 22 Rue de Rivoli, and that I am at home to my friends every Saturday evening. So now, you gentlemen cannot plead ignorance both of when and where you may see me, if so inclined."
The young men bowed and quitted the box. Upon reaching their stalls, they found the whole of the audience in the parterre standing up and directing their gaze towards the box formerly possessed by the ambassador of Russia. Following the universal example, the friends perceived that an individual of from 35 to 40 years of age, dressed in deep black, had just entered, accompanied by a female dressed after the Eastern style. The lady was young and surpassingly beautiful, while the rich magnificence of her attire drew all eyes upon her.
"By heavens," said Albert, "it is Monte Cristo himself with his fair Greek."
The strangers were, indeed, no other than the Count and Ade. The sensation excited by the beauty and dazzling appearance of the latter soon communicated itself to every part of the theatre, and even ladies leaned forwards from the boxes to admire the many-coloured coruscations that darted their sparkling beams whenever the superb diamonds worn by the young Greek played and glittered among the cut-glass lustres with their waxen lights. The second act passed away during one continued buzz of voices, one deep whisper, intimating that some great and universally interesting event had occurred. All eyes, all thoughts, were occupied with the young and beautiful female, whose gorgeous apparel and splendid jewels threw an air of insignificance upon all the fair visitants of the theatre. The business of the stage was utterly neglected. All seemed to consider the contemplation of so much loveliness far more deserving attention.
Upon this occasion, an unmistakable sign from Madame Danglars intimated her desire to see Albert in her box directly the curtain fell on the second act, and neither the politeness nor good taste of Morcerf would permit his neglecting an invitation so unequivocally given. At the close of the act, he therefore proceeded to the Baroness's loge. Having bowed to the two ladies, he extended his hand to Debray. By the Baroness he was most graciously welcomed, while Eugénie received him with her accustomed coldness.
"My dear fellow," said Debray, "you have just come in the very nick of time to help a fellow creature regularly beaten and at a standstill. There is Madame, overwhelming me with questions respecting the Count. She insists upon it that I can tell her his birth, education and parentage, where he came from and whither he is going. Being no disciple of Cagliostro, I was wholly unable to do this. So, by way of getting out of the scrape, I said, 'Ask Morcerf. He has got the whole history of his beloved Monte Cristo at his fingers' ends.' Whereupon the Baroness made you a sign to come hither, and now I leave the solution of her questions in your hands." "Is it not almost incredible," said Madame Danglars, "that a person having at least 500,000 of secret service money at his command should possess so little information upon so everyday a matter as the present?"
"Let me assure you, madame," said Lucien, "that had I really the sum you mention at my disposal, I would employ it more profitably than in troubling myself to obtain particulars respecting the Count of Monte Cristo, whose only merit in my eyes consists in his being twice as rich as a nabob. However, I have turned the business over to Morcerf, so pray settle it with him as may be most agreeable to you. For my own part, I care nothing about the Count or his mysterious doings. I am very sure no nabob of our time would have sent me a pair of horses worth 32,000 francs, wearing on their heads 4 diamonds valued at 5,000 francs each."
"He seems to have a mania for diamonds," said Morcerf, smiling, "and I verily believe that, like Potemkin, he keeps his pockets filled for the sake of strewing them along the road, as little Thumb did his flintstones."
"Perhaps he has discovered some mine," said Madame Danglars. "I suppose you know he has an order for unlimited credit on the Baron's banking establishment."
"I was not aware of it," replied Albert, "but I can readily believe it."
"And further, that he stated to Monsieur Danglars his intention of only staying a year in Paris, during which time he proposed to spend 6 millions. He must be the Shah of Persia, travelling incog. Have you remarked the extreme beauty of that young female by whom he is accompanied, Monsieur Lucien?" inquired Eugénie.
"I really never met with one woman so ready to do justice to the charms of another as yourself. Let us see how far she merits your praises," continued Lucien, raising his lorgnette to his eye. "A most lovely creature, upon my soul," cried he, after a long and searching scrutiny. "Who is this young person, Monsieur Morcerf?" inquired Eugénie. "Does anybody know?"
"Allow me to state," said Albert, replying to this direct appeal, "that I can give you very tolerable information on that subject, as well as on most points relative to the singular person of whom we are now conversing. The young female is a Greek."
"So I should presume by her dress. If, therefore, you know no more than that one self-evident fact, the whole of the spectators in the theatre are as well informed as yourself."
"I am extremely sorry you find me so ignorant a cicerone," replied Morcerf, "but I am reluctantly obliged to confess I have nothing further to communicate. Yes, stay, I do know one thing more, namely, that she is a musician, for one day that I chanced to be breakfasting with the Count, I heard the sound of a guzla. It is impossible it could have been touched by any finger than her own. Then your count entertains visitors, does he? Asked Madame Danglars.
Indeed he does, and in a most noble manner, I can assure you. I must try and persuade Monsieur Danglars to invite him to a ball or dinner, or something of the sort, that he may be compelled to ask us in return.
What? Said Debray, laughing. Do you really mean you would go to his house?
Why not? My husband would accompany me.
But do you know this mysterious count is a bachelor?
You have ample proof to the contrary if you look opposite, said the Baroness, as she laughingly pointed to the beautiful Greek.
No, no, exclaimed Debray. That female is not his wife. He told us himself she was his slave. Do you not recollect, Morcerf, his telling us so at your breakfast?
Well, then, said the Baroness, if slave she be, she has all the air and manners of a princess.
Of the Arabian Nights, if you like.
But tell me, my good Lucien, what is it that constitutes a princess?
Gold, silver, and jewels, and our Greek beauty there is one blaze of diamonds. I doubt if any queens could equal them.
To me, she seems overloaded, observed Eugenie. She would look far better if she wore fewer, and we should then be able to see her finely formed throat and wrists.
See how the artist peeps out, exclaimed Madame Danglars. My poor Eugenie, you must conceal your passion for the fine arts.
I admire all that is beautiful in art or nature, returned the young lady.
What do you think of the Count? Inquired Debray. He is not much amiss, according to my ideas of good looks.
The Count, repeated Eugenie, as though it had not occurred to her to observe him sooner.
The Count? Oh, he is so dreadfully pale.
I quite agree with you, said Morcerf, and it is in that very paleness that consists the secret we want to find out. The Countess G insists upon it. He is a vampire.
Then the Countess G has returned to Paris, has she? Inquired the Baroness.
Is that she, Mama? Asked Eugenie.
Almost opposite to us, with that profusion of beautiful light hair.
Yes, yes, there she is, cried Madame Danglars.
Shall I tell you what you ought to do, Morcerf?
Command me, madame. I am all attention.
Well, then, you should go and bring your Count of Monte Cristo to us.
What for? Asked Eugenie.
What for? Why, to converse with him, of course. If you have no curiosity to hear whether he expresses himself like other people, I can assure you I have.
Have you really no desire to be introduced to this singular being?
None whatever, replied Eugenie.
Strange girl, murmured the Baroness. He will very probably come of his own accord, said Morcerf.
There, do you see, madame, he recognizes you and bows. The Baroness returned the salute in the most smiling and graceful manner.
Well, said Morcerf, I may as well be magnanimous and tear myself away to forward your wishes. Adieu. I will go and try if there are any means of speaking to him.
Go straight to his box. That will be the simplest plan.
But I have never been presented.
Presented to whom?
To the beautiful Greek.
You say she is only a slave?
Well, you assert that she is a queen, or at least a princess. No, no, I cannot venture to enter his box. But I hope that when he observes me leave you, he will come and take my place.
We shall see. It is just probable. Therefore, go at once.
Adieu. I sacrifice myself, remember that, said Albert, as he made his parting bow. As he had predicted, just as he was passing the Count's box, the door opened and Monte Cristo came forth. After giving some directions to Ali, who stood in the lobby, the Count observed Albert and, taking his arm, walked onwards with him. Carefully closing the box door, Ali placed himself before it, while a crowd of wondering spectators assembled round the unconscious Nubian.
"Upon my word," said Monte Cristo, "Paris is a strange city, and the Parisians are very singular people. Do pray observe that cluster of persons collected round poor Ali, who is as much astonished as themselves. Really, one might suppose he was the only Nubian they had ever beheld. Now I will pledge myself that a Frenchman might show himself in public either in Tunis, Constantinople, Baghdad, or Cairo without drawing a circle of gazers around him. That shows that the Eastern nations have too much good sense to waste their time and attention on objects undeserving of either. However, as far as Ali is concerned, I can assure you the interest he excites is merely from the circumstance of his being your attendant. You, who are at this moment the most celebrated and fashionable person in Paris.
Really? And what has procured me so flattering a distinction?
What? Why, yourself, to be sure. You give away horses worth 1,000 guineas. You save the lives of ladies of high rank and beauty. You send thoroughbred racers to contest the prize of the jockey club, the horses being rode by tiny urchins not larger than marmots. Then, when you have carried off the golden trophy of victory, instead of setting any value on it, you give it to the first handsome woman you think of. And who has filled your head with all this nonsense? Why, in the first place, I heard it from Madame Danglars, who, by the by, is dying to see you in her box, or to have you seen there by others. Secondly, I learned it from Beauchamp's journal, and thirdly, from my own imagination. Why, if you sought concealment, did you call your horse Vampa?
That was an oversight, certainly, replied the Count. But tell me, does the Comte de Morcerf never visit the opera? I have been looking for him, but without success.
He will be here tonight. In what part of the house? In the Baroness's loge, I believe.
Is the charming young female with her daughter?
Yes,
indeed. Then I congratulate you.
Morcerf smiled. We will discuss that subject at length some future time, said he. But what think you of the music?
What music?
That which you have just heard.
Oh, it is admirable as the production of a human composer, sung by a party of bipeds without feathers, as Diogenes styled mankind.
Why, my dear Count, would you have me understand that you undervalue our terrestrial harmony because you can at pleasure enjoy the seraphic strains that proceed from the 7 choirs of paradise?
You are right in some degree. But when I wish to listen to sounds so exquisitely attuned to melody as mortal ear never yet listened to, I go to sleep.
Then why not indulge yourself at once? Sleep, by all means, if such be your means of procuring the concord of celestial sounds. Pray, do not hesitate. You will find every incentive to slumber, and for what else but to send people to sleep was the opera invented.
No, thank you.
Your orchestra is rather too noisy to admit the soft wooing of the drowsy god. The sleep, after the manner I have mentioned, and to produce the desired effects, absolute calm and silence are necessary, and a certain preparation must also be called in aid.
I know, the famous hachis, precisely.
Now you know my secret. Let me recommend you, my dear Viscount, to come and sup with me whenever you wish to be regaled with music really worth listening to.
I have already enjoyed that treat when breakfasting with you, said Morcerf.
Do you mean at Rome?
I do.
Ah, then I suppose you heard Ade's Guzla. The poor exile frequently beguiles a weary hour in playing over to me the airs of her native land.
Morcerf did not pursue the subject, and Monte Cristo himself fell into a silent reverie.
The bell rang at this moment for the rising of the curtain.
"You will excuse my leaving you," said the Count, turning in the direction of his loge.
"What? Are you going?
Pray, say everything that is kind to Countess G, on the part of her friend, the vampire.
And what message shall I convey to the Baroness?
That, with her permission, I propose doing myself the honour of paying my respects in the course of the evening."
The third act had now commenced, and during its progress the Comte de Morcerf, according to promise, made his appearance in the box of Madame Danglars. The Comte de Morcerf was not one of those persons whose aspect would create either interest or curiosity in a place of public amusement. His presence, therefore, was wholly unnoticed, save by the occupants of the box in which he had just seated himself. The quick eye of Monte Cristo, however, marked his coming, and a slight, though meaning, smile passed over his lips as he did so. Ade, whose soul seemed centered in the business of the stage, like all unsophisticated natures, delighted in whatever addressed itself to the eye or ear. The third act passed off as usual. Mademoiselles Noble, Julie, and Leroux executed the customary quantity of pirouettes, Robert, Julie challenged the Prince of Granada, and the royal parent of the Princess Isabella, taking his daughter by the hand, swept round the stage with majestic strides, the better to display the rich folds of his velvet robe and mantle. After which the curtain again fell, and the spectators poured forth from the theatre into the lobbies and salon. The Count, quitting his box, proceeded at once to the box of Madame Danglars, who could scarcely restrain a cry of mingled pleasure and surprise.
"Welcome, Monsieur le Comte," exclaimed she as he entered. "I have been most anxious to see you, that I might repeat verbally those thanks writing can so ill express."
"Surely so trifling a circumstance cannot deserve a place in your remembrance. Believe me, madame, I had entirely forgotten it,
but it is not so easy.